always a pleasure to be here. And it's a pleasure to talk about something that I've been doing with Laurent and Alejandro Perez in Marseille. And so we're going to talk about boundaries. Remember when I was here last time in it was April, I think, and there was this workshop on quantum groups. And there was Herman Berlinde who gave a talk. And he made this point that somehow strings and loops are dual to each other in the sense that loop people always focus on the bulk and never really worry about what happens in the boundary. And on the other side, string people mainly focus on what happens on the boundary and struggle to record what happens in the bulk. So in a way, what we have done is trying to fill that gap and try to actually look at what's going on the boundary from the point of view of loops. And so let me start with a couple of old ideas, which have been revised during the years. And they are quite simple ideas in a sense, but at the same time, it's not easy to really pinpoint the implications of these ideas in a concrete way oftentimes. So the first idea is that when you introduce a boundary, you break gauge symmetries. And in order to somehow recover the symmetries that you break, you need to add new degrees of freedom. This is, again, this is an old idea that during the years has been revised by several people, even more recently. And it's basically the starting point of our work. The second idea that is somehow related is the fact that when you have a boundary around the puncture, then some CFT degrees of freedom should appear. And this is also an idea that probably, I don't know if it was Witten, the first one, but at least it goes back to 89 and then it's been revised as well. So, okay, this is the two ideas I wanted to bring up at the beginning. Now, these new degrees of freedom that arise when you have boundaries are physical. This is the point we want to try to make. In particular, I'm going to try to convince you that these degrees of freedom represent all boundary possible boundary conditions that you need to include if you want to reconstruct expectation values of observables in gravity, all sorts of observables. In particular, they correspond to this notion of partial observables, which, for instance, could you can understand them as detectors on the boundary or physical boundary conditions. So basically, partial observables are a component of a relative observable, which is a gauge invariant object. And the partial observable is what you get when you somehow choose a reference to look at one part of the relative, the components of the gauge invariant relative observables. I will try to make this concept more precise. This is just to give you the main message I'm trying to convey here. At the same time, you can see that these degrees of freedom are necessary if you want to reconstruct the Hilbert space, the total Hilbert space, once you divide the Hilbert space in subsystems. You can call these degrees of freedom, for instance, edge states or soft modes. And they really encode entanglement between subsystems. So they represent degrees of freedom that one needs to include in order to couple subsystem into one subsystem to another in a gauge invariant way. So this is what I was saying at the beginning. They're necessary to recover gauge invariants. OK, so this is the points I will try to make during the talk. Now, let me give you some ingredients that I'm going to use. The first one is the introduction of a generalized Gibbons-Hawking-York boundary term in the action for gravity in the first order of formalism. Then the new boundary gauges of freedom that appear, they organize themselves under representation of conformal symmetry. And this is achieved basically by replacing puncture singularities with a circle. So basically, we are thickening the spin networks into somehow spin tubes. And this is how the conformal symmetry arises. This was postulated some time ago. That was the right thing to do by Lee and together with Mayer also, and more recently as somehow reserved in the context of spinform amplitudes by the work of Aldo and his collaborators. The last ingredient I'm going to use is the assumption of a background geometry. So I'm going to use the bulk variables as background fields. And then I'm going to look at the degrees of freedom that arise in the presence of these background fields. In particular, I'm going to assume that tangential curvature on the boundary vanishes everywhere except at certain points, which are the puncture, so a set of punctures on the boundary. And in a way, this can be motivated from the recent introduction of a dual vacuum in loop gravity, which somehow was hinted by Bianchi in 2009, and then Loranna with Zippi somehow established the existence of this, at the same classical level, this dual vacuum. And Bianchi and Mark basically implemented this idea in the quantum theory. So these are the three ingredients. And now let's start with the first one, which is the introduction of the boundary term in the action. So we're going to consider the canonical structure of GR in the first Hopper formalism on a 3D slice, space-like slice, when there is a 2D boundary, which is punctured by spin networks. And so we assume the topology of a space-like surface to be, or the manifold to be a space-like surface M cross R. And there is a boundary, which is a two-sphere. This is the standard bulk action in the first-order formalism of GR. What we add is this boundary term here. And I'm going to explain exactly what this boundary term here. First, let me tell you what the variables that appear here are. So we have the Mirzi parameter, gamma. E is the frame field. Omega is the 4D spin connection. Then this A that enters in the boundary action is this combination here, which is not really a connection, in the sense it doesn't really transform a connection unless gamma is equal to I. But this covariant derivative is the same tensorial structure of this D of A is the same tensorial structure of a covariant derivative as if this was a proper space-time connection. And then the E in the bulk is the standard flux, which is defined through the simplicity constraint. Where you notice that this extra term that appears is the Holst term, which gives this topological addiction to the bulk action, which vanishes on shells. It's a topological contribution. So also notice that due to this boundary term, now the action is differentiable for any variation of fields. Okay? Now let me tell you what this boundary term is. So this boundary term is basically nothing else that so first of all, you can explicitly it takes this form when you write the A as star omega plus omega. And we see that this quantity here, the first quantity, is nothing else than the Gibbons-Holt-New-York term written in the first order variables. In fact, if you choose a gauge where basically one of the tetrad is the normal to the surface, then it's quite immediate to see that this quantity reduced to the trace of the extrinsic curvature times the square root of the determinant of the metric on the surface. The second term is, again, like in the case of the Holst term, it's a term that vanishes on shell due to the torsionless condition. And if you want, it's somehow a natural complement of the Holst term in the bulk. So we add this extra term to the standard Gibbons-Holton term. This is how we define this boundary term. Now, we introduce the time gauge because we want to do a canonical analysis. So we, as usual, we fix the normal to be aligned to one of the tetrad component. And then we define the SC2 Ashdegger-Barbero connection in the standard way. And now the coframe fields, the fluxes sigma are written in terms of the coframe fields, which are tangent to the space-like surface M. And then you can see that the symplectic form now acquires a boundary term. So we have the standard term of the bulk, where the connection is conjugate to sigma. And then there is this new term, which is written in terms of the triad on the two-sphere. On the two-sphere. So what we're doing, basically, we are extending the phase space. We are adding a boundary phase space component, which is parameterized by this triad, and the Poisson brackets that you can read from this symplectic form is this one here for the boundary. You have the standard one in the bulk, And you get this non-commutativity in terms of Poisson brackets for the triad field. Now, as I was saying again, in the back, you have the standard variables. You have the flux to form sigma and the SU2 connection A. And the constraints are the same. You have the Gauss law, the diffeo constraint, which we write in this form here, but it's, if for people who are not familiar, it's exactly the same diffeo constraint that you oftentimes see, where this phi is a tangent vector to the surface M, the space-like surface M. And then, of course, you have also the scalar constraint, which I haven't written in full, but there is this first part and then the standard second part where you have the gamma dependence and the explicit extrinsic curvature dependence. So now we want to see the back fields, sigma and A, as background fields, which they commute with the boundary triad, as you can see from the phase space structure. So in particular, we can, so a priori, the triad commutes with these bulk fields. However, you see that in order to preserve the gauge, both internal and diffeos gauge, you need to impose additional boundary constraints. And the first one is basically this boundary Gauss law, which is nothing else than somehow a boundary simplicity constraint. So this is telling you how to couple the flux coming from the bulk with the triad living on the boundary. And I'm going to show more clearly how this indeed is a component of the Gauss law on the boundary. So somehow you can understand this boundary simplicity constraint as a replacement for a boundary condition where you fix the metric on the surface. Yeah.
So at the beginning, what are the variables or the degrees of freedom of when you start from the action, you did not say it's the action that depends on these fields. But now you have boundary fields. And
so the action depends in the bulk. You have the spin connection. No, sorry. The omega, the spin connection, and the E, which is the flux, the standard flux. Now, on the boundary, you have the triad. When you go to normal gauge, you fix one of the components of the tetrad, so the dynamical variables are just the triad left.
So they are independent.
In the independent, yes. As you can see from the phase space structure, you see like E commutes with both A and sigma. The only Poisson brackets that you have is between A, the non-trivial Poisson bracket is between A and sigma in the bulk, and E with itself. All the other Poisson brackets vanish. It's the when you look at the boundary conditions that you have, when you vary the action written above, you discover that there is this constraint, which tells you how to couple the boundary triad with the bulk flux. And notice that this constraint, basically now, due to the Poisson brackets of the triad, is telling you that the fluxes, the bulk fluxes, don't commute anymore, already classically. So you can see it's not really true that fluxes, the non-commutativity of the fluxes is a quantum, it's a consequence of the quantum theory. It's actually, it follows from the classical theory once you consider boundaries. And the second constraint that you get is this, is also a boundary component of the diffeo constraint, which basically corresponds to the torsion free condition plus a condition on the embedding, on a restriction on the extrinsic curvature. And so in this way, we can think of the set of all the admissible boundary frames, the triad, as labeling all the possible boundary geometries which satisfy these boundary conditions. And as I was saying before, we are assuming that we're not allowed variation of E0, so, since we're in a time gauge. Okay. So now, the second ingredient is this background geometry that I was mentioning. So we are assuming that there is a fundamental discretness input coming from the bulk. We have a puncture that appears on the two sphere when there is spin at the links that arrives. And what we do, we regularize this curvature singularity by basically cutting a disk around the puncture. And so now we have a circle, Cp, and then there is the rest of the surface, on the boundary surface, which we call B bar. So this is the complement. And we introduce a complex structure on the two sphere, which basically amounts to introducing these complex coordinates, z and z bar. And we can now we can look at the components on the boundary of the variables that we have. So the you see that on the boundary, sigma z and z bar commutes with az and az bar, simply because these are both tangential coordinates. So even though in general sigma does not commute with a, when you restrict to the, when you pull back on the boundary, they commute. So a priori you can choose both of them arbitrarily. You don't have any restriction if you choose one of them and the other one. And so the sigma, as I was saying before, is determined basically by the boundary simplicity constraint, and is given as a function of the boundary frames on the surface. So this is the restriction. What determines sigma on the boundary is the commutator of the E's. So D is a disk, which could be either could be the, a disk around the puncture, or it could be a disk in the complement at this stage. And this is the general expression for the fluxes. Now, what I was saying before is that we assume the tangential curvature component of A to vanish everywhere except when we have a puncture. So basically, we have this background structure for the curvature, where K is a background field, which labels basically the curvature, the tangential curvature of the connection. So this parameterizes this background curvature. In particular, like if you have an holonomy, it goes around a puncture, so on this C of the circle, you get this expression, exponential 2 pi k for the holonomy around the puncture. Okay. So with this assumption of background geometry, now we can look at the Hamiltonian generators of the constraints. We use the standard covariant phase space formalism, where basically you can read the Poisson brackets from the symplectic to form, and also you can look, read off the Hamiltonian generators of the transformation from the symplectic to form. In particular, we want to look at the Gauss and the Diffeo constraint that you get from the symplectic structure, and you read them from basically inserting a variation in the symplectic form which are associated to gauge transformation or tangential diffeomorphism. And if you do this, basically you can read this expression for G and for S, and this is what you get. So you see here, this is the expression for the Gauss constraint, the Hamiltonian generator of Gauss transformations. And you see that if you do an integration by part of this object in the bulk, you would get the standard dA of sigma, which is the standard Gauss constraint in the bulk, plus a boundary term, which is exactly this boundary simplicity constraint. So there is a contribution from this quantity, and then a contribution when you do the integration by part. What you get is exactly this boundary simplicity constraint. So you get the standard Gauss law in the bulk plus this component for the boundary. And this generator for the boundary variable for the triad generates this transformation, these internal rotations. So this is just an SU2 rotation for the triad on the boundary. This is the generator of the Diffeo. So again, we have a boundary term that appears. This is the standard bulk term. Phi is a tangential vector field to the space-like surface. And this also, you can see that it generates Diffeo transformation. The boundary term generates Diffeo transformation for the boundary variable E. So these are the two constraints. Now we can look at the algebra again using this covariant phase space formalism. And we need to plug in the variation associated to gauge and diffeos, which I wrote here, but this is just standard gauge and diffeo transformations. And what you get is this algebra here. So in particular, what you see is that this algebra is no longer first class. due to the presence of boundaries. You see, you get boundary contributions that make this algebra no longer first class. And this is the indicator that in the presence of boundaries, you break page symmetries, and you need to restore them by adding new degrees of freedom, which now become physical. So you cannot kill all the gauge degrees of freedom anymore due to this second class nature of the algebra, and some of them become physical. Now, let's characterize these degrees of freedom more precisely. So as I was saying before, we want to study the quantization of this system in presence of background fields. We define these boundary charges, Q, on a disk as given here, where again, this pi is a S2-valued field. And you can see that on shell, the statistical constraint, these charges can be written, basically, they give you this relation here. They give you that the Q on the complement of the surface where you remove the disks are given by the sum of all the puncture of charges that you can write only in terms of circle integrals. So these charges are basically really live only on the circle. And now, we want to compute the algebra of these charges. What we use is the Poisson brackets of the triad. And we also solve the curvature condition, basically by we go to the neighborhood of a puncture, and we fix the gauge so that the connection takes this form here. So around each puncture, you can always fix a gauge. Theta is the angle goes around the puncture. R is the radius of the disk. And the connection takes this form around the puncture. If we use this together with this Poisson bracket, when you compute the algebra of these charges, you get this expression here, which is a Kac-Moody algebra. Actually, it's a twisted Kac-Moody algebra. It's twisted by the presence of the curvature here. Particularly, if you write now the modes of these charges in this form, using this definition here, then the modes of the charges satisfy this algebra here, which maybe it's more familiar for someone who knows Kac-Moody algebra. And you see that this K is a twist that you have due to the presence of curvature. So, so if you have any curvature, you get the standard U1. These are three copies of U1 Kac-Moody algebra. And where the central extension this normalization is equal to 1. Now, in the presence of curvature, it's more convenient to go to a complex basis for the SU2. In particular, we introduce this tau A defined here and with these commutators. And this complex basis basically diagonalize this matrix K, where now this index A goes from 3 plus minus and A bar is 3 minus plus. So in this basis, basically, you see that the algebra that I wrote before can be written in this form here. Notice that the sum of all these k's is equal to 0. So this is the Kac-Moody algebra structure that follows directly from the gravitational symplectic structure that we have when you had this boundary term and you assume this distributional configurations for the curvature. Also, yes, a side note, basically the theory with k and k plus 1 are equivalent. So this is somehow is telling you that the connection is compactified. And this is something that follows directly from the continuum theory. You don't really need to go to the quantum theory to see this. And also, we restrict this k to take values in integer over n, where n is also an integer, so rational values. So there are questions or? Okay. So now from the Kac-Moody generate modes, we can construct the Virasoro ones in a standard way. Particularly, you can see that the boundary diffeomorphism along a vector field which is tangent to the true sphere can be defined again in the same way. And it takes this.
Sorry, Daniel, I have a question.
Yeah.
Maybe for the previous one. I'm not sure. Maybe the previous slide, everybody got it. You said it, but maybe fast. Like initially, you were saying, you know, the charges, like the the E. Mm-hmm. Okay? And initially we had that the E and the E has this ultra-local nature,
yeah,
bracket. So
yeah.
How is it that somehow, you know, we, you know, you now get this Gagmudi. So somehow there's this delocalization of the bracket around the circle. You didn't mention the role of the staticity constraint.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I don't think if it was clear for people, okay, that somehow there's a bit of a miracle happening there. In the
So,
the way you go from...
You see, so basically, when you do, these are definitional charges. Now, when you do an integration by part of this charge, you get something which is dA of E, which is the statistical constraint, plus a boundary term, which is a circle term, which is this quantity here. So if you impose the statistical constraint, these charges basically become just a circle integral. And that's basically, that's what happened. That's how you see that when you compute now the algebra of these charges, you get a commutator which only depends on the values of the field on the circle. It doesn't depend anymore on what's inside in the disk in the bulk. It's because of the statistical constraint that this delocalization happens. Yeah? Or okay. So yeah, so the Virasoro generators basically the Virasoro modes are the modes of the tangent diffeo generator, which is also again written only as a circle integral here, and they are defined through this relation. And explicitly, you can basically you see that the LNs are given by the integral of the circle of the theta theta component of this generator. And this is actually also, notice, this is also the theta theta component of the metric on the true sphere. So what we have is basically that the Virasoro modes are related to the true metric on the true sphere. And you can construct, you can show that these modes are given by the Sugawara construction, from the Sugawara construction by the Kac-Moody charges from this relation here. So if you use this relation and the algebra of the Qs, you can prove that this L satisfies Virasoro algebra, where C is the central charge, which is equal to 3. So you see how you get, again, just from pure algebraic arguments, a Virasoro algebra falling from the symplectic structure of gravity in presence of boundary. And a way to see that these currents are primary fields, it's from the algebra of the Ls with the Qs, which is the typical algebra for a primary field of weight 1. OK, so now what happens to the local SU2 symmetry, which is generated by the sigmas? So we want to see what happens when we don't vary, we leave the background fields invariant, but we only look at what happens on the boundary. And what you can see is that when the curvature is integer valued, you can write, again, the generators of SU2 boundary gauge transformations in terms of the Qs. This is the form you get. This is basically like the analog of a Schwinger representation, just it's an infinite dimensional extension of the Schwinger representation that you have. And these are, this generator here satisfy an SU2 algebra. You can show that this is an SU2 algebra. So in particular, what you have is that at each puncture, now you have, you recover the usual SU2 symmetry times an infinite dimensional symmetry, which is the Virasoro algebra that I showed you before. So this is this new boundary symmetry group, which is obviously much bigger. And this defines new boundary observables. In general, you see that, so the important thing to notice that these fluxes, the M's in the complement on the surface, does not vanish anymore. So the flux on the complement away from the puncture is now given by the sum of the fluxes around all the punctures. So you can see this as a violation, if you want, the closure constraint. And this is basically the other thing I was mentioning, the fact that somehow we are working with a dual vacuum, a vacuum where the flux is not annihilated anymore away from the punctures. Now, let me give you a physical understanding of why these are new degrees of freedom. So what we saw the other day, yesterday, in fact, like if you have a spin network link and you cut it at the boundary, now you get some entanglement between one side of the link with the other side of the link. And this entanglement is encoded by the SU2 quantum numbers, that is by the SU2 symmetry quantum numbers, the magnetic numbers, and give you, if you compute the entanglement entropy between this part of the link and this part of the link, it gives you an entanglement entropy, which goes like the dimension of the representation. Now, so this is when you have just an SU2 boundary symmetry. In this case, where basically the link now is replaced by a tube and the puncture by a circle, we still have the SU2 plus the Virasoro. So we have a new quantum number. And now these new quantum numbers, we also contribute to the entanglement between this part of the system and this other part of the system. So in general, what you would expect is that now the entanglement entropy would depend on both quantum numbers. So the delta 0 here is the eigenvalue of the L0 mod of the Virasoro algebra. And J is the SU2 spin. So this is in the sense of what I was trying to say before. These new degrees of freedom encode entanglement between the subsystems. In particular, you can see them as shapes of the circle. These degrees of freedom encodes the possible shapes of the circle when you keep the background fields fixed. See, these are all the possible shapes compatible with the background fields that you have in the body. So what we did is to identify and somehow provide a quantum description of the soft modes of gravity at the boundary. Now, these are new physical degrees of freedom in the sense that they restore gauge symmetry in the presence of a boundary. And they define surface charges, which are partial observable, in the sense that it's made explicit in these works. And what we want to understand now is the nature of the symmetry generators associated with the complement of the surface, because this would bring in this interpretation in terms of a 3D auxiliary string, which is what we call the loop string. But this is the main point of the talk. So if you have questions about this new degrees of freedom, please ask here, because the rest is just technicalities about how to describe them in terms of currents and strings and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Yes, so these new degrees of freedom, are they sometimes, I don't know, in the literature, what I think people call soft modes and edge modes, isn't it usually different? So, typically, what Laurent and William have studied, isn't it different than what people call the edge modes, which you get from looking at the boundary observables that you get by requiring that the constraints be functionally differential?
Yeah, this is exactly what we did, right? Basically, by exactly assuming differentiability, we get this extension of the boundary constraint in the bulk, in the boundary. And this is because we add new degrees of freedom, this triad. So you recover the this is the generator of the SU2 internal symmetry. You recover the SU2 algebra by adding this term. And this is because you add these new degrees of freedom. So in that sense, our edge modes, and exactly in that sense that you say that they're necessary to get to restore the symmetry. They are basically, it's like a new degeneracy that you have. It's a new degeneracy that you introduce in the presence of a fixed background field that tell you how to couple the bulk with the boundary in a gauge invariant way. So, and as I was trying to stress before, for instance, in the case of this increasing constraint, this is clear. It really tells you how the bulk field has to be coupled to the boundary one so that you have a situ symmetry.
So just what I was also asking is, well, maybe Laurent knows, but from, you know, from reading your paper, it seemed that the symmetries that you get on these boundaries are different from what you get here. You don't have Virasoro times SU2. You're saying that you have APDs times
So with William, we gave a general idea that you need to add terms, and then these terms become physical. And then there is the gauge, and then there's generator of symmetry. What Daniel is saying here is that that was kind of a semi-classical analysis. Now, you know, Daniel is presenting what happens if you try to quantize that. And for that, he's taking a loop gravity, a dual loop vacuum, right? So, and he's, is showing that in the presence of this dual loop vacua, he's looking at a subset of this algebra in the context of a background field, which is right, which is in, and the motivation for this background field is loop inspired, but right?
It's a subset of the algebra that you have.
It's a sub, yeah. The algebra with William was a semi-classical. Nobody has ever quantized it. It's a subset in the in a background which is inspired by the dual vacuum, in some sense.
Yeah, in right? particular.
So it's a sector of gravity which talks to,
Yeah, in particular, we haven't really looked, for instance, at the time diffeomorphism. In this analysis, we only look at the tangent diffeos.
Okay, yeah.
There would be like really just all this around the shapes of the circle not being. Okay, so. There should be another copy of Virasoro.
Yeah, okay.
So, if this is clear, then let me just give you an idea of how you get this stringy description. So, as I was saying before, now when you go around. So you can fix the gauge by for the connection in this way, and this group element G basically has this periodicity property. Now, you can go to a frame in which basically you set the connection to zero, and you get that the E field now is not periodic anymore, but it's quasi-periodic. That satisfies this quasi-periodicity condition here. So this is just a frame in which it's easier to work, but it's the same. The background structure is the same. You have curvature around punctures, and this is encoded in this quasi periodicity of the E field that we denote E hat. So E hat is a quasi periodic triad, and now we can assume that the connection to vanish. So this is how we keep track of the curvature. And now what we do is basically to the Hamiltonian action of these Kakmudi charges is basically this translation gauge symmetry here. Now we want to gauge fix those transformations that vanish on the circle. So in particular, we want to gauge fix all these diffeos that moves puncture around. That's the idea. We just want to look at the degrees of freedom on the circle. And to do that, we introduce a gauge fixing, which is given by this condition here, which you can see is a good gauge fixing because the only transformation which basically annihilate the Poisson bracket with the generator of the transformations that we're trying to get fixed are those which are trivially zero everywhere if they're zero on the circle. So only the only transformation that survive are the trivial ones. I mean, the only transformation that give a zero Poisson bracket with the gauge fixing. So this is a good gauge fixing for the gauge symmetry that we have in the bulk. And we want to solve now this gauge fixing and the statistical constraint at the same time on the complement of the surface, so away from the puncture. To do that, we basically look for the general solution of the statistical constraint, which again, now since the connection is zero, is only the zero derivative of E hat. And this is given by this expression here, where we introduce some auxiliary scalar fields, X. And imposition of the gauge fixing now gives this condition on this axis. So basically, this axis now are scalar fields which satisfy holomorphicity property. But here, they can be written as the solution of this equation is basically this factorization of x in the holomorphic and anthropomorphic part. And the frame fields now become proportional to these conserved currents, where the j's are this, exactly these conserved currents given in terms of the scalar fields. So the scalar fields are just auxiliary fields that we use to parameterize the solutions of the staticity constraint and the gauge fixing. And they give us these expressions here for the triad fields. Now, again, if you go to this complex basis, you can parameterize the symplectic structure using these solutions. And what you get is this expression here. So you parameterize the symplectic structure in terms of this axis, which from which eventually you can read the algebra of the currents when you express this in terms of the modes. So what we want to do is to basically rederive the Kac-Moody algebra in terms of this current algebra. To do that, we do an expansion in modes of these currents, the holomorphic, the anti-holomorphic part. And again, this is why you see that the restriction of K is necessary, because it's basically you can really make sense of this mode expansion only when K has this rational value. So this is like some frequentization condition that comes from this mode expansion. There is some reality condition, which is in terms of the modes takes the form. But so anyway, the point is that now if you write the components of the theta components of the tri in terms of these currents, the modes of these currents, which we call Qn, you can parameterize the phase space in terms of this Qn. And from this Poisson bracket, again, you recover exactly the Kac-Moody algebra that I showed you before, plus a zero mode term that appears in the mode expansion of the axis that I've done. So these are, again, this is simply a reparametrization in terms of string currents. Just to basically, it tells you that you can understand these triad fields in terms of string currents. And again, now you can look at the Virasoro generators in the same way. You can write them in terms of these currents. As I was saying before, what you obtain is that the two-dimensional metric on the boundary basically corresponds to the stress energy tensor of the string. However, like we only recover the theta theta component, since we haven't really looked at the radial part of the triad. Now, the more interesting could be the fluxes. As I was saying before, this is the expression of the fluxes that come from the simplicity constraint. And now we want to look if there is a non-trivial algebra that this flux is satisfied when we don't vary the bulk fields. We only look at the variation of the fields on the boundary. So what happens is that if you, the non-trivial algebra is only possible with basically for those SH rotations which don't rotate the connection, particularly those for which the covariant derivative of alpha is equal to zero. And this, so there is a subset of SH rotation parameterized by alpha such that this condition is actually satisfied when k, the curvature, is an integer. In this case, you can also see that this is also the case where this flux can be written as a circle integral. Otherwise, this is not obvious, right? Because here you have an ER and E theta component. And it's not obvious that you can write this quantity as a circle quantity. But this is possible actually when k is an integer. And the final expression that you get for the modes is the one I showed you before. This is the general expression here, which again, you can show that gives you this SU2 algebra. So you have a representation of the local SU2 algebra in terms of these new currents. And the flux, so the flux of loop gravity, it's really the angular momentum of the string around the circle. So this basically, this SU2 symmetry that seemed to be broken by this U1 to the third is actually recovered through this reconstruction here. And it's follows from the implementation of the boundary gas constraint that I think it's written. Yeah. So then the question is, so are we really using the classical loop picture or not? And the answer is, as I was saying before, is not really. What we're using is this new dual vacuum, because you can see that the flux in the away from the puncture is given by the sum of these fluxes around the punctures. In fact, this is exactly the same philosophy that this new vacuum has, that only the curvature basically is assumed to vanish away from the puncture. And the problem with this new vacuum is that it's not really renormalizable. It's not normalizable. Here, there might be hope, because this is basically a Fock vacuum. So we could actually, once we have a proper construction of the Hilbert space, we could see if this vacuum is normalizable. And the fact that it should have a Fock structure is a good indication that this should be the case. So let me give you an outlook of what we did. We found these new charges, surface charges, which encode entanglement between subsystems. Now, as I was saying before, these new charges have to be taken into account when you compute entanglement entropy, and they can account, for instance, for horizon entropy. Also, one could use this entanglement in this idea of emergent space from entanglement that could be tested in some other concrete way in this picture where we have this new degrees of freedom. At the same time, as I was saying before, these are soft air in the sense of what Hawking and Perry and Strominger suggested to be the degrees of freedom of black hole entropy. It can also provide a realization of this idea of ER equal to PR. We can describe, we could use now these boundary CFT correlations to describe back geometry and eventually to get some effective semi-classical dynamics from entanglement renormalization. This is somehow an idea that is quite popular these days. And an indication that this can be possible come from this paper of Laurent with Kashnov and Edera, where basically they show that the amplitude for a coherent intertwiner basically is related to the correlation function of CFT in the boundary of ADS. So there might be a way to actually relate the dynamics in the bulk to boundary CFT correlations, and this can provide a way to describe the bulk dynamics in terms of the boundary degrees of freedom. And then another possibility is that since now we want to blow everything up, we can have new observables which can be used to define matter degrees of freedom. Particularly, we can couple matter degrees of freedom to these new circles and understand them as, eventually we would like to understand them as matter degrees of freedom. So the picture we would have is something like this sort of like a Virasoro spin networks everywhere with this, these circles attached to where the intertwiner now is like these spheres, and you have these new boundaries, and then you have the Virasoro charges all along the cubes. And I conclude.
Where did you get that picture?
Google.
Did you type Virasoro spin network? And
not quite.
Have you thought about dynamics?
Yeah, so there are two possibilities somehow. The one is the one was mentioned before, using this duality between bulk and boundary to investigate the dynamics of bulk curvature in terms of boundary correlations. The other possibility, since now we basically have the triad available as an operator, to try to construct a definition of the Hamiltonian constraint in terms of the triad, which should provide less ambiguities, since most of the ambiguities that you have in the usual construction of the Hamiltonian constraint is due to the use of fluxes. But since now we don't really have to rely anymore on fluxes, there is hope that at least some of the ambiguities would go away, and this might provide a simpler somehow definition of the Hamiltonian constraint. But we haven't really looked into that direction. In fact, we haven't really looked at the So as I was saying before, we found only one half of the copies of the Virasoro, because we only look at the diff fields around tangent diff fields. There should be more coming from the Hamiltonian constraint, because also the Hamiltonian constraint now would get boundary terms, which probably would break the symmetry. And you, to restore it, you will need to define charges associated to that as well. So that is something that needs to be understood, and that we haven't really looked into that yet.
OK, a related question. If you have a Virasoro algebra with a degree of freedom for each puncture,
yeah,
then you have an infinite number of degrees of freedom. Mm-hmm. So you've lost the relation between area.
Between?
Area. Area.
Well, we haven't really done the counting yet, because we don't really have the full structure. But if you use the Calvi formula for the asymptotic expression of the density of states, then the number of degrees of freedom somehow should be still be finite, in the sense that there would be a cutoff coming from the fact that only low spin, in a sense, contribute to the expression, and that would still give you probably a holographic bound on the degrees of freedom. I mean, it's a usual Calvi formula. When you use Calvi formula to count the asymptotic of states, you have an infinite power of states, but then the actual asymptotic formula is finite, it's not infinite. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea, that you should recover it.
Another way to see the same thing is the fact that the area is defined in terms of the metric. The Virasoro generator is the metric. So if you restrict the area, you're restricting the Virasoro. So now you're still carrying a number of, you know.
Yeah.
It's just like they are not independent. They are the same thing. So the Virasoro and the area, of course, talk to each other, like the zero mode.
Yeah, I mean,
it has to be all proven, but it's
yeah.
It's like if you impose that the area is finite, what you're doing is you're compactifying the Virasoro representation. Mm-hmm. You're imposing that the sum of the en, like if you go back to your formula, you're imposing that the sum of the squares of e is smaller than something, and therefore, the e cannot be as big as. So there's a. It's not as simple as.
Yeah, I mean, we need to understand the coupling between the quantum numbers coming from the CFT with the quantum
yes.
numbers coming from the bulk. But since we have a notion of energy associated to the CFT, the L0 modes of the Virasoro, and there is a notion of energy which somehow is related to the area, at least in the context of local observer, then. The natural expectation is that the zero mode of the eigenvalues of the zero mode of the Virasoro, which are the one that enters in the Calvi formula, should be given by the J's of loop quantum gravity, so that if you have a finite area, you should have a finite answer for
it. It would be great to show that.
Yeah.
And that relation between the energy Moulin tensor and the metric is very reminiscent of ADS-CFT.
There is definitely some ADS-CFT lurking somewhere here, because, for instance, as I was mentioning, this result of Laurent with Edera and Kirill that shows exactly that if you look at the amplitude of this coherent intertwiner, this is given by this correlation function of the CFT on ADS-CFT. And basically, what we are basically doing here is to show that the labels of the coherent intertwiner are this Z that appears in this definition of the Smoody charges. So we are actually defining what these labels that before you just used, but you don't really know what they are. where they really come from. So there is definitely ground for investigation in that direction.
Students have no questions?
Yeah.
Presumably you have a non-critical string here, so have you tried to reverse the logic and say, given some non-critical string with some central charge, can you make up LQG kinematics for it?
Well, this is a very peculiar string.
Sure. Yeah.
It's in fact, it's not exactly a string in the proper sense, in the sense that the central charge doesn't vanish.
Right. Yeah. So it's non-critical.
Yeah. So I mean, the connection is really that the triad is the current. So if you want, I mean, that is
okay.
the connection.
Thank you, Daniele, again.